Good morning and welcome to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Steve Romanen, hoping everybody had a good, relaxing, long weekend, especially the folks I met or saw at the Thinking About Animals conference at the end of last week. It was a great couple of long, long days, and hopefully everybody got a lot of rest. I met some great folks, including some of our loyal listeners, and a member of our team that I didn't even know existed. So I want to thank Erin O'Sullivan, Neil Harvey's partner, for the work she does assisting Neil in editing our shows and bringing them to our international listeners each and every week. We'll be sure to get her a spot on the biography page on our website as soon as possible so that she can be recognized for her work. As promised, I have some content from the conference to share with you folks today, about three lengthier clips ranging from 10 to 15 minutes each. Many of the clips that I recorded are from the book launch for Critical Theory and Animal Liberation, a new book edited by John Sanbunmatsu, who we'll be sure to have on the show sometime soon. Although I didn't get as many recordings as I wanted, I will be having quite a few of the folks whose presentations I either saw and loved or heard about from friends and wanted to hear more on the show soon. So you, our listeners, and I will be exploring some of that content and those presentations together over the next few weeks. Before we get to those clips, however, we have someone here from the Toronto Vegetarian Association to tell us a little bit about an event that I've been plugging for a few weeks now, Veggielicious. David, are you there?
Yeah, hi Steve.
How you doing today?
I'm good.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Veggielicious, about what people can expect if they go out and check this out?
Sure. Well, Veggielicious is a celebration of compassionate cuisine. Our goal is to showcase food that's good for you, good for the planet, and cruelty-free. We have something for everyone with Veggielicious. We have over 20 participating businesses at almost 50 locations, which are located across the GTA. And there are gourmet specials, heart-healthy options, as well as comfort foods like pizza, veggie burgers, and South Indian dosas. And the menus and the maps of participating businesses are online at veggielicious.ca.
Can you tell us, what are you looking forward to, David?
Well, you know, I think first and foremost, I'm looking forward to a week that just celebrates great vegetarian food. I mean, I don't think our restaurants in Toronto get enough credit for the great job they do, the vegetarian businesses in particular. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to some of the specials that are on offer. Fresh is bringing back a dish called the Ninja Bowl, which features sun-dried tomatoes, greens, tofu cubes, and sunflower sprouts over brown rice or soba noodles in spicy ginger tamari sauce. And that'll be available for $15 with a 16-ounce juice and a dessert cupcake. So that's a pretty good deal. I'm also looking forward to some of the specials that Doopie Palace, they have a dosa special and a South Indian thali option, both for $9.99. We've also got Sadie's Diner and Urban Herbivore, and Lix actually has a bunch of deals with a newly veganized nature chili. So that's all stuff that my stomach is looking forward to, for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe I'll be sticking around Toronto after the show from now on.
Yeah, well, at least from the 9th until the 25th.
Yeah, I know as well, I'm from St. Catharines, and I know that there's some restaurants in St. Catharines participating as well, so I want to mention Pan Cafe and Brooklyn's and St. Catharines are going to be participating in this as well. So yeah, thank you so much for letting us know about that, David, and for organizing this. I think it's really awesome. You know, in previous years, I've felt sort of left out from events like Summerlicious, and it's really great that somebody's getting it off the ground so that we can sort of have our own event as well.
And it's a volunteer-driven initiative, so I have to pass on the thanks to one of our volunteers, Lisa, who's pretty much taken the lead on this one. I think it is really a great opportunity for people who haven't tried vegetarian food before to get out there and try out some of the great offerings that are available in this city.
Thank you so much, David.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
That was David from the Toronto Vegetarian Association telling us a little bit about Veggielicious. If you want to find out more, of course, you can check out veggielicious.ca with all the menus, all the participating places, and of course, a contest that you can enter for a prize pack from Guardian. Moving right along, we have up next a fantastic track from Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. I'll let him tell you a little more about the artist himself.
Greetings, Animal Voices. It's Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. This week's soundscape comes from Saylove. Saylove grew up in Maine in the 80s. Her father, a jazz musician, influenced her young musical talent. As a child, she taught herself to play Casio keyboard, chopped up tracks on a cassette player, sang and wrote song lyrics. Her experience in social justice dates to her adolescence. With brothers and peers growing up in juvenile detention and in prison, Saylove studied law seeking alternatives. Between 2008 and 2009, Saylove completed a master's in peace education at the UN-mandated University for Peace in Costa Rica. There she worked at Beats 106 and with inmates at San Rafael Prison. January 2010, she organized Hip Hop for Haiti, Costa Rica, in liaison with Epicentro Urbano. Her work then expanded with TAP Network, researching the impact of art on peace internationally. July 2010, Saylove submitted her thesis, a first paper to address the presence of critical pedagogy in hip-hop culture. Saylove recently recorded her soulful throwback LP, The Original Mix, that will soon be available on iTunes. You can learn more about Saylove and other vegan hip-hop artists on the Vegan Hip-Hop Movement Blogspot, Facebook, and MySpace pages. And now from Saylove, Wayside.
Kitchen visit up and nine, oh, what they vision. Hot dog scenes, butter bread, condiment fixings. Hunt's easy squeeze, be the centerpiece. Please pass my boy a tray, I'm okay, I need none of these. Shorty with a smile, sweet, offers me a brownie. I said alright to thank you, I couldn't pass it down. Be happy with the cream, spoon the sugar in the cup. Rush into the table quick, so you could sip it up.
French's with a spoon and a styrofoam cup. Yo, I spread it on some bread and proceeded to eat it up.
What you eating, a grind in my finger?
Nah, these ain't cadaver parts, I'm just starving, sister. Even though these flesh-colored logs look suspicious, I bet if I close my eyes and wish they might be delicious. Besides, say I gotta take a chance cause I'm broke. I'm betting these winos are wishing for rum and coke.
It's a psychopathic social, I suppose the eyes are closer to the short fuse. Looking at me, what's he gonna do? Perhaps pull something like a shame out of shoes. Ghetto crews, not to amuse, maybe you read the news. Front page reviews, our streets making revenues with too few mental health workers and professionals. He's a chocolate snack. I'm a rock mahalo with no eye contact. Just rock mahalo with no eye contact.
Fake meat, gutter, sludge, supper that would make my mother cringe into a vomit buster. So I add mustard and ketchup so I can step up and embrace the disgusting taste of this entree made of toxic waste. What a disgrace that I place myself in such a predicament. But I have to pace myself so I won't start feeling sick. I really wish I had my mom's home cooking now. I looked around the room and I raised an eyebrow.
Hey, hey guys, yo, Jay. You guys are new around here. I want to help you out.
Look, it says right on it's super cookie.
It's a super cookie.
It's probably damn good. You should try it.
Bite. I swear it's a cookie.
Chocolate chips and all this.
Just eat it. Might be cockroach, roach pots, who the hell knows. But try it anyway. It's good. It's a good freaking cookie.
Kinda Stanley Crumbly, what's it look like to you?
Keep like Batman, but more like Pac-Man and Pikachu.
But with the hair flat, looking like Felix the cat on crack. With his eyes crossed, looking like a messed up snack. Blue, white, yellow, and black. Funny colors for the bat. I wonder if somebody in county made that, cause I gotta tip my hat. Wouldn't it be cool if we had one just like it? I wouldn't even eat the thing, I'd name it, what a riot.
That cartoon cookie there sure looks strange. We can take it with us home.
To end this pain, cause I'm getting dizzy and I'm really feeling nauseous.
Well, to me it's no surprise that eating mop chops toxic. This taste is obnoxious, yeah, I got the door.
Why you gotta talk about body parts for? You know my belly hurts, yet you keep on pushing it.
Well, you never know what those meat grinders mushing it.
Pushing shit in front of my face, the steaming plate made me want to regurgitate. I couldn't imagine chasing that mess with KO pectate to ease my stomach lining. If I said I didn't want to be at mom's dining, I'd be lying. Give me a roast chicken dinner with the gravy and the greens. Don't forget about the homemade biscuits, yo, what a daydream. Vanilla ice cream with the hot fudge sauce and the cherry on top. You'll forget this slop, this bullshit needs to stop. I can't take it at all. I'm about to lose my mind to something else in a bathroom stall.
Swag display stacks as if it's showing you love, but it supports masochistic acts and bottles of blood. You were seeking sustenance. We come to this place, it's perpetuating sickness. It's such a disgrace. Wish we had our own land where we could just breathe. Cause sunshine, rain, and a handful of seeds is all we truly need. And forget the rest. Takes time to detox and you feel so fresh.
Digestive stress, yo, my stomach needs some rest. Can I borrow a couple dollars for some Tums and Crest?
I got my peppermint tea and Tums at home. Plus the main ingredient, let's go get in the zone. Man, yo, I'm really sorry we have to come out here.
I feel really bad.
No, for real, like,
it's okay.
No, I feel bad, man.
Do just the fact that you're my son, like, oh, I mean,
hey man, I might got something for you, man. I know I'm sorry I keep bugging you guys, but hey, now I just found this tumbling, half a tumbling, 15 cents right now, man, on this one. So, hey, man, hey, I'm trying to, like, look, I got these granola bars, man. I got half a cheeseburger.
It's okay, I'm feeling a little sick.
Oh, come on now. Come on, man. I got yo, half a tum.
Come on,
man. 15 yo, cents, man. Off, man. Cents for half off, a tum. You can't beat that, man. Them is like swap meat prices.
And we're back. The first presentation I want to play for you folks this morning is coincidentally the first presentation that I saw at the conference. It marked the beginning of two incredible days wherein I met some truly inspiring people who I'd read about or talked to through this program but had not met in person until last week. One of those folks is David Nybert, whose presentation, Conflict, Violence, and the Demesecration of Animals, was a real treat to kick off the Thinking About Animals conference at Brock University. I am pleased now to bring to you that conference presentation here on Animal Voices.
As activists and scholars, we tend to be confronted routinely by people with arguments to try to undermine our advocacy for animals. And I'd like to briefly discuss two of those arguments and discuss them within the context of a critique of the capitalist system. The first argument that you all heard, I'm sure, is that your priorities are wrong. You should be focusing on human problems. We need to take care of human problems first. And secondly, our detractors will say that actually the use of animals has contributed to the development of human civilization. So I just want to briefly take a look at those two arguments. I was told at an early age that the domestication of other animals was a benign partnership between humans and other animals that facilitated the advancement of social progress. And over time, I've come to think that the term domestication has become a euphemism for the tragic treatment and exploitation of other animals. Other animals have been desecrated. So I am substituting the word domestication for domestication. And when our species began to domesticate other animals roughly 10 to 12,000 years ago, one of the awful consequences was the development of these deadly zoonotic diseases that have been absolutely devastating for our species over time, including smallpox. Roughly 7,000 years ago, the domestication of other animals took a turn and that nomadic pastoralists emerged. And nomadic pastoralists were actually, their own impact on the development of human civilization has been devastating. They were warriors, and in many instances, they were very vicious warriors, and they rampaged Eurasia, and millions of people died, and countless others enslaved by powerful nomadic pastoralists. My point is that the nomadic pastoralists who were exploiting other animals, horses as instruments of warfare, which were the tanks of the day for thousands of years, and provided them with mobility, plus the other animals that were traveling with them, large numbers of animals, they continued to have to expand to get grasslands and water for these animals. So the domestication of other animals both promoted violence and enabled violence. Enabled violence because of the use of other animals as instruments of warfare and using other animals as rations. And it promoted violence because they needed to continually expand, that is, continually invade other areas. So from the beginning, the domestication of other animals was deeply entangled with the enormous level of violence amongst our species. By the way, it wasn't just nomadic pastoralists. Imperials and empires like Rome thoroughly depended upon other animals. Without horses and cows, for example, they could not have continued their own imperialist ventures, you know, throughout Europe and Northern Africa. Colonization, you know, these awful past 500 years where Western civilization, or the European Empire, and then closely followed by the U.S. Empire, began to invade other parts of the world, thoroughly dependent upon domesticated animals. Again, if we look just at the Western Hemisphere, Christopher Columbus and Cortez and Pizarro, if they hadn't have had the horses, if they hadn't had the cows, they hadn't had the sheep and goats, they could not have had their way with the inhabitants of the Western Hemisphere. And even then, with those animals promoting and enabling that invasion, had it not been for the deadly zoonotic diseases that jump species from other animals to humans, that took an enormous amount of life of people in the Western Hemisphere and around the world, that the deadly colonization and those imperialist adventures that couldn't have happened. They were fueled, by the way, a lot of the Spanish conquistadors came from families who were ranchers, so they continued to expand, raising increasing numbers of cows and sheep, and the hair of the sheep and the skin of the cows and the fat of the cows created great wealth. They were huge exports, and sometimes far above those being generated by sugar and other plantation. So the history of Ireland, Scotland, Africa, the Western Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand, all was a direct product of domestication. Elites coming in, expanding the numbers of cows and sheep, killing people, displacing people, enslaving people. That's the history of the past 500 years, deeply connected to the domestication of other animals. And, of course, it wasn't just the people in these other places who were devastated. Free-living animals as well, from the buffalo of the Western Plains to the kangaroos in Australia, just devastating for other animals as elites came in, expanding ranching industry and displacing anyone who was in their path. And for those imperialist adventures that weren't directly driven by ranching enterprises, they were still enabled when the Dutch East India Company started invading Indonesia and Southeast Asia. They were thoroughly dependent upon horses as instruments of warfare and as other animals as rations. They hadn't been exporting other animals, those adventures most likely would not have occurred. And it was domestication of animals that facilitated the powerful and malicious political, economic, social system we have today, which is capitalism. It began in part with the enclosures in Europe, subsistence people being pushed off the land as elites began to use that land to raise sheep for the nascent textile industry in Europe. In this way, land became private property. Labor became a marketable item, but then it was fueled by tremendous amounts of wealth pouring in from throughout the world, particularly the Western Hemisphere. A great deal of gold and silver, particularly silver, coming in from Bolivia, fueling the rise of the capitalist system. And of course, those mines, they could not have operated those mines without tremendous exploitation of other animals, in addition to the enslavement of humans. And then, of course, they use that wealth in Europe to a large degree to generate wars, as much as is done today, especially in the United States. And capitalism then, in turn, drove domestication. In the beginning of the 20th century, the use of other animals to enable warfare as instruments of war tended to decline, but the exploitation of other animals as rations expanded greatly, as did agribusiness in countries like the United States, and people were exhorted to eat increasing levels of animal products. As retailers in the United States sought to expand the hamburger culture, they began to look south, especially for cheaper sources of ground beef. And the 20th century, terrible history of exploitation and violence in Central America, due in no small part to loans and grants, primarily loans, from institutions like the World Bank, who were promoting the expansion of ranching in Latin America. It was particularly devastating in Central America, where people were pushed off their land and people resisted over time, and their resistance was construed, or presented rather, in the United States as areas were being infiltrated by communist rebels, and the U.S. military-industrial complex was basically turned on them. Thousands of people killed in Latin America, many of them rising up trying to defend their own homelands. And those people who were displaced ended up in large metropolitan areas, now cheap labor for multinational corporations, while the level of malnutrition and hunger grew. But the hamburger culture expanded in the United States. Latin America wasn't going to go the way of Cuba, from the point of view of the U.S. elites. And also this expansion of the hamburger culture within the United States was a form of structural violence against everyone who was introduced to Ronald McDonald and exhorted you to consume animal products. And amongst the entangled harms today, domestication taking this horrible form of this increasingly intensive factory farming, these zoonotic diseases are not left behind. And public health scientists, as many of you know, around the world are terrified at the outbreak of a deadly influenza virus. When H1N1 emerged, they can trace its origins back in part to pig farms in North Carolina. They were somewhat relieved that the death toll was not higher than it was, but they're bracing themselves for the next mutation. Not social progress. As you all know, this is not a sustainable system. The global population is growing, and agribusiness intends to profit, to squeeze every dollar until the apocalypse occurs. Consumption of animal products is expected to double, perhaps within the next 40 years. It's absolutely not sustainable. Enormous resources, finite resources, are being used up, not the least of which is fresh water, fossil fuel, rainforests being destroyed, and of course, animal agriculture being one of the leading, especially meat production, being one of the leading causes of global warming. And this is not lost on the empire of the 21st century, and the CIA has had their eye on this situation for a long time. You can glimpse some unclassified reports in the United States from time to time, and it is clear that the powerful in the United States are looking to the future and they can see what's coming, and they're going to continue to pour enormous amount of resources into the military. So domestication is still deeply entangled with human violence and warfare. So when our friends and colleagues say, you've got a good heart, but your priorities are misplaced, we have to say, if you're working for animal rights, you're working for human rights. The destiny of most of the inhabitants of the planet is going to turn in part on whether domestication continues, and the animal industrial complex, you know, continues to exercise such enormous economic and political force. And I thoroughly believe that domestication has been devastating for our species. You have to wonder what life would be like today if 10,000 years ago, if they hadn't begun domesticating those other animals, if it hadn't turned to nomadic pastoralism, if all of those thousands of people hadn't been killed, if the very basis for modern civilization was not so deeply rooted in all of that violence that is directly related to domestication, you know, what would life be like on the planet today? And especially if we didn't have the capitalist system rushing us toward growing devastation. Okay, thank you.
An interesting, informative presentation by David Nybert here on Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Our next presentation is from Zipporah Weisberg from York University. Her presentation last year at the Institute for Critical Animal Studies conference at SUNY Cortland was fantastic, and I was pleased to record two amazing talks by Zipporah at this year's Thinking About Animals conference at Brock University. Here she is with her presentation, Animal Monstrosities, Technocapital, and the Reification of Animal Life.
I'm going to be continuing in this vein of the critique of capitalism, but I'll be focusing on one specific issue, which is the reification of animal life, as my title suggests. And I'll be engaging more directly in this case with the theoretical and philosophical tradition around this issue. So in my talk today, I suggest that there is a dialectical relationship between the commodification of animal life and the reification of human consciousness under capitalism. Specifically, I suggest that there is an inextricable link between the normalization of violence against animals in the agricultural, medical, entertainment, and fashion industries, and the contemporary subject's isolation, despair, neurosis, and political paralysis. The subordination of human and animal life to technique, or the totalitarian organization of social, economic, intellectual, and erotic activity according to mathematically precise principles and methods, and the concomitant prioritization of quantity over quality and means over ends, has had especially deleterious effects on human-animal relationality. With the rise of information and digital technologies, the human subject is more detached from the life world than ever before, and her capacity for dissent and protest is more crippled than ever. It is therefore crucial for the left in general, and ecological Marxists in particular, to embrace animal liberation as central to the emancipatory project as a whole. To continue to marginalize animal liberation is to seriously jeopardize the otherwise laudable efforts being made to produce a free, creative, active social and political subject out of the inferno of techno-capitalist civilization. The reduction of animals to automata by René Descartes in the 16th century, as well as the mechanistic turn in scientific thought and praxis heralded by Francis Bacon in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, paved the way for what is now virtually unchecked systemic violence against animals in the name of scientific and techno-capitalist progress. With the development of industrial capitalism in the early to mid-19th century, other animals' fate, to be forever treated as the mere stuff of control, to use Herbert Marcuse's expression, was tragically sealed. The total annihilation of animal subjectivity is now at its apogee with the rise of biotechnology and its ruthless objectification of other animals at the genetic and ontological level. The animal body provides limitless material for endlessly expanded reproduction. As David Harvey suggests, progress in the age of the global village not only translates into the annihilation of space through time, but also dangerously prioritizes becoming or limitless transformation and manipulation over being or ontological integrity. This conception of progress as metaphysically regressive could not be truer for other animals who are denied the opportunity to be themselves as themselves and by themselves, and are instead reduced to instances or means in a process which has no end, no telos, save its own infinite perpetuation. So-called battery hens and broiler chickens are a horrifying case in point. In Karen Davis's words, quote, "Factory farm chickens are not only in factories, they are regarded by the chicken industry as factories that allow for a continually manipulated adjustment of their bodies to fit the iron conditions of commerce," end quote. While the suffering of other animals under capitalism must be addressed as a problem in its own right, it is important to recognize that the human subject distorts itself, albeit psychically, as it maims and tortures other animals. That the commodification of other animals is symptomatic of the reification of human consciousness and its degradation. Hungarian Marxist George Lukács explained that when the commodity is, quote, the universal category of society, the rationalization of capitalist society reaches the worker's soul, end quote. In the commodified universe, reification, quote, stamps its imprint upon the whole consciousness of man. His qualities and abilities are no longer an organic part of his personality. They are things which he can own or dispose of, like the various objects of the external world, end quote. The worker no longer regards herself as an active, creative, willing subject, but rather as an inert object in a rationalized system over which she has no control. Indeed, the totalitarianism of technique, defined by French sociologist Jacques Ellul as, quote, the totality of methods rationally arrived at and having absolute efficiency in every field of human activity, end quote, is another factor leading to the reification of human consciousness. Every activity is reduced to a procedure. In a wholly commodified society, any independent thought, any unique qualities or idiosyncrasies the worker may exhibit, quote, appear increasingly as mere sources of error, end quote. Indeed, as Herbert Marcuse points out, in this context, any refusal of the system not only appears as neurotic, but even insane. While it is clear that Lukács was concerned with the reification of the working class subject under its subjugation by the bourgeoisie, his analysis can be extended to apply to the reification of the human subject in general and its commodification of the life world, in a kind of inversion of his formula. The subject has internalized the logic of rationalization upon which capitalist society is organized so deeply that mass torture and murder appears totally normal. Reification reduces humans' potentially rich, multifaceted, emotionally charged, and ethically oriented relationship to other animals to one of often brutally violent, standardized procedure. The internalization of technical and mechanical logic amounts to the transformation of the human subject into an efficient animal-killing machine. Indeed, slaughterhouse and factory farm workers represent the completion of this reification process. Their physical and psychic activity has been totally mechanized and routinized, and any impulse they might otherwise have had to assist other fellow sentient beings in need is necessarily obliterated as it contradicts the logic of production. Consider the worker whose job it is to sort wanted from unwanted newly hatched chicks passing by on the assembly line and to throw the tiny creatures into giant macerators to be ground alive. Such work demands that she likewise dispose of her own empathy as so much trash, for empathy would only slow down the efficiency of the otherwise smoothly running death machine. Animal experimenters also epitomize the reified consciousness. They do not realize that by objectifying animals in their laboratories as so much raw material to be cut apart, they also objectify themselves, that they cheat themselves of a fundamental dimension of human experience. For, as David Abram puts it, quote, "We are human only in contact and conviviality with what is not human," end quote. With contact reduced to violation and conviviality replaced with detachment, the experimenter is reduced to a pale imitation of what an enriched and fulfilled human subject ought to be and could be. The fragmentation of the subject is another symptom of reification. Just as the work process is broken down into specialized components, reification fragments the consciousness and life activity of the worker. In Lukács's words, quote, "The fragmentation of the object of production necessarily entails the fragmentation of its subject," end quote. Biotechnology, genetic engineering, and factory farming are practices which thrive on the literal fragmentation and hybridization of the animal and human subject. As noted above, animals are custom made to meet the demands of the market. They are reduced to parts and pieces to be disassembled, rearranged, reassembled, sometimes with the parts and genes of other animals, sometimes even with computer chips. We have made them into veritable monsters. Therefore, the tendency of many post-structuralist thinkers, such as Michel Foucault, Donna Haraway, or Gilles Deleuze, to celebrate the death of the subject is tantamount to an affirmation of, not a threat to, repressive techno-capitalist civilization. As I have noted elsewhere, Donna Haraway's whimsical and ironic theorizing about the radical potentiality of boundary dissolution between animals and machines effectively amounts to an apology for animals' merciless objectification and their genetic, physical, and psychological manipulation by the animal industrial complex. Hybridity ought therefore to be rejected as a fundamentally reactionary concept, which reinforces rather than undermines the logic of late capitalism. Though seemingly innocuous, the rise of cybernetic and digital technologies and devices is deepening the reification of consciousness. While these technologies facilitate instant communication, and so, for example, are helpful tools for organizing protests and other activist events, their disadvantages greatly outweigh their advantages, in my view. This culture of distraction has effectively replaced sensuous and erotic interaction with other beings with the sedentary, robotic, and time-spaced compressed activity of fiddling with various gadgets. Real tactile interaction has been largely superseded by virtual, which is to say artificial, interaction. As she is drawn ever deeper into cyberspace, the subject is becoming increasingly insular. Rather than soaking up the warm sunlight on her skin, hearing the soft hum of the summer breeze as it gently caresses the leaves of the trees, the typical subject is completely withdrawn into a digitalized world of simulacra. She is more familiar with the chirping of ringtones than with the chirping of birds. With head bowed, eyes glued to her BlackBerry, and fingers furiously tapping away at the keys, she is completely oblivious to the richness, magic, and beauty of the more than human world around her, or that which remains of it. The subject's obsessive preoccupation with and addiction to her cell phone, iPod, Facebook, and so on has diminished her sense of presence, of being with other beings in the world. Indeed, the ubiquity of these gadgets has radically dislocated and disoriented the contemporary subject and hurled her further than ever before into the chaos of schizoid temporality. As a subject takes flight into cyberspace, she loses her footing and her orientation on the ground. The dizziness contributes to political impotence. To paraphrase Terry Eagleton, if the postmodern subject is so schizoid as to be unable to tie its own shoelaces, how can it possibly topple the state? Furthermore, the ubiquity of digital technologies and social networking have deepened what Hannah Arendt saw as the collapse of the political and the social in late capitalist society. With the internet readily available everywhere and at all times, critical time for reflection, for thinking with oneself, and therefore for political action, is gravely threatened. Without the opportunity to reflect, people can no longer make solid political, ethical, or existential judgments, which are so central to critical theory and praxis. With critique and self-reflexivity abandoned, the conscience, or conscience, which Arendt tells us literally means to know with and by myself, loses its platform for analysis and action, and any manner of atrocity is possible. With these insights about the dialectical relationship between the commodification of animal life and human consciousness and mind, it becomes clear that the development of the human revolutionary subject is incomplete unless and until it sees in the other animal's objectification and subjugation its own freedom. I'm speeding up here just because I'm running out of time. The left's silence on and or hostility towards animal liberation undermines the possibility of creating the conditions for the development of a truly rational and free human being, free from scarcity and want, and free to actualize itself and all its creative, erotic, and intellectual potentialities. The reluctance of the left to consider the joint plight of humans and animals under capitalism is itself symptomatic of reification. Leading ecological Marxist Murray Bookchin acknowledges that, quote, humanity must show a conscious respect for the spontaneity of the natural world, that ecology recognizes no hierarchy on the level of the ecosystem, and that there are no kings of the beast and no lowly ants. Nevertheless, he sees fit to condemn the pursuit of equality between humans and animals as misanthropic. And that's a quote. In so doing, he flatly contradicts the tenets of his own anti-hierarchical and anarcho-communist social ecology. Indeed, he completely misunderstands and misrepresents the historical development leading up to modern capitalism's institutionalization of barbarism against humans and non-humans by attributing it to humans' lingering animality. This self-righteous anthropocentrism paradoxically nullifies the entire socialist humanist project. To have any hope of achieving its goal of creating a world free of the evils of commodity fetishism, a shift in consciousness with the left, or in the left, is paramount. One way to precipitate this shift in consciousness is to weave a critique of atrocities against animals into dialectical accounts of history, that is, to reconceive history along non-anthropocentric lines. I look to Theodore Adorno and Walter Benjamin and their respective critiques of the Hegelian conception of universal history for assistance in beginning this process. To counter the violence of universal history, in which bloodshed on the slaughter bench of history is regarded as an unfortunate but necessary evil in the progress towards absolute freedom, Benjamin and Adorno insist on the remembrance of the particular, of each and every victim of violence. The suffering of one never trumps that of another. Rather, all are regarded as part of a constellation, each a partial truth that helps illuminate the whole. The whole that bears illuminating in history is history itself, which is aptly described by Benjamin as one single catastrophe. There is a total and single truth to history, but it is not, as Adorno tells us, the progress from unreason to reason and barbarism to civilization. In his words, quote, no universal history leads from savagery to humanitarianism, but there is one leading from the slingshot to the megaton bomb, end quote. How can one deny that the same history has led from the spear to the live macerator? Similarly, how can one deny that atrocities against animals are not part of the one single catastrophe Benjamin describes? Indeed, I think Adorno and Benjamin, who condemn the domination of nature for its irrationality and cruelty, would be hard-pressed to deny that the so-called dead piles, or the heaps of injured, dying, and dead animals found outside slaughterhouses, literally discarded for their lack of economic worth as a result of injury or disease, are among the greatest indictments against the barbarism of universal history and the myth of progress which accompanies it. But the reevaluation of dialectical historical transformation must go further than this. Animals must be regarded as historical subjects. To conceive of animals as historical subjects is not to erase their victimization by attributing false agency to them. Bruno Latour and Donna Haraway's characterization of animals as inanimate objects, alike as agents or actors, for example, is grossly misleading. Essential to any system of domination is to strip the dominated of their agency. Isolated acts of resistance on the parts of animals against their tormentors are heroic, but do not constitute political agency as such. While cattle and other farm animals who are doubly exploited for their dead bodies and for their abstract labor power may be the new proletariat, according to Bob Torres, they cannot start a revolution to overcome species domination. Nor can they emerge out of the master-slave dialectic as self-conscious essential subjects, as in the case of colonized people rising up against the colonizers or women against men. When I refer to the animal as a new historical subject, then, I mean simply that the development of the human revolutionary subject is incomplete unless and until it sees in the other animal's objectification and subjugation its own freedom. Putting it another way, the self-consciousness required to complete the materialist dialectic at this juncture in history, or perhaps to end history as we know it altogether, is one which sees the human species for what it really is, now, today, in contrast with what it ought to be. This true self-consciousness would reveal that the human subject is at its most barbaric and irrational ever, and that the shameless atrocities committed against billions of sensitive, sentient beings is not just a, but indeed the leading symptom of this barbarism and irrationality. This true self-consciousness would illuminate the incompatibility of true freedom for human beings under socialism with the continuation of mass torture and murder of other animals. And only once the killing stops will the human subject triumph against its total reification. Thank you.
A fantastic, albeit somewhat jargon-laden presentation from Zipporah Weisberg here on Animal Voices. Hopefully you guys were able to follow along and didn't get lost in the social scientific vernacular of her presentation. It looks like we have just enough time for one more presentation, a slightly shorter talk by Vasil Stanektsu, whose paper regarding happy meat appeared in the Journal for Critical Animal Studies last year and appears in John Sanbonmatsu's Critical Theory and Animal Liberation, which was launched at the Thinking About Animals conference this year.
A defense of veganism, why critical animal studies scholars and animal rights activists should be worried about the rise of locavorism, free-range, humane, or happy meat. There's a new genre of text arising, epitomized by such books as Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma, Barbara Kingsolver, Animal, Vegetable, Miracle, Catherine Freed, The Compassionate Carnivore, Simon Ferrelli's Meat, A Benign Exuberance, and Liara Keyes' The Vegetarian Myth. Despite their various titles, in essence, all these books forward very similar arguments for the small-scale and sustainable farming of animals. The one chapter I have in the book deals specifically with Pollan's work and Kingsolver and the idea of locavorism. And since universally these texts criticize factory farms in a sort of my enemy's enemy is my friend type of reasoning, some animal rights activists and theories originally welcomed these texts as possible fellow travelers or coalition partners in the quest to end industrial agribusiness. Perhaps, it was hoped, we could simply agree to disagree until the 99% of all animal-based food currently produced in factory farms, at least within the United States, which we both feel is devastating, was removed, before we worried if the best solution was a fully vegan diet versus the consumption of humanely raised grass-fed beef from small-scale and local farms. After all, starting where we currently are, both sides seem nearly equally utopian. At a generous estimate, only 1 to 2% of the entire American population is currently vegan, and less than 1% of animal food is at least supposedly raised humanely. Why then, one may fairly ask, should we invest any time arguing against locavores, compassionate carnivores, or supposedly free-range or humane meat when nearly 99% of the population only eats meat from exclusively factory farms 99% of the time? However, the reality is that none of these texts only argue against factory farms or in favor of small-scale and local farms. Instead, universally, all of them spend as much time arguing against vegetarianism and veganism as they do against factory farms and industrial agriculture. This is shown even in the title of the most recent text. For example, books such as The Vegetarian Myth, The Compassionate Carnivore, and Meat, A Benign Extravagance are, in reality, all deeply scathing critiques of factory farms and industrial agriculture, both arguments of which I deeply agree. But yet, at the same time, as the title suggests, the impetus is less against factory farming, or even for small-scale agriculture, than it is repeatedly and explicitly anti-vegan and anti-vegetarian. For example, here's the write-up of the back of the most recent text, Meat, A Benign Extravagance, by Simon Ferrelli. In the debate over eating meat, vegetarianism developed two winning truths. Vegetarians are better for human health and better for the environment. Meat explodes these truths with a groundbreaking exploration of the environmental, ethical, and social issues surrounding humans eating meat and the future of farming livestock. And what is true of the books themselves is even more true of the media representation of the text, which, at the risk of offending the authors, is the main way that virtually any of their arguments will be taken in by the larger public. Hence, these books are universally discussed in the media via titles that suggest that all vegans are wrong and that all eating of meat from any source and at any scale is a positive good in the world. For example, just to take the title of the reviews of Ferrelli's work, Why Eating Meat is Good for the Planet. Vegans are wrong. Eating meat is only a benign extravagance. Carnivores rejoice. Eating meat is great for the planet. The case for eating meat and even five ways meat eating can save the earth. If eating a little meat is good for the planet, it is reasoned, surely eating a lot must be even better. What all such title, jacket covers, and headlines omit is that in order to claim meat can ever be sustainable, Frehley requires that not only all factory farms be ended, but also that all people eat only at least half as much meat as they currently consume, all human food scraps have to be fed to livestock, and even that people need to learn to enjoy skin, animal skin, offal, and bone. Pollen is similarly utopian, and I talk about this in the chapter of the book, requiring a complete transformation of the entire system of the entire agricultural production, both animal and non-animal, requiring in essence any food produced to be grown or raised within a local and personally visible community. But perhaps Liara Keith's book, A Vegetarian, the Myth, is the most extreme, in which to be able to argue that eating meat could be environmentally sustainable, Keith argues that the population should be decreased from 6 billion to 6 million, all industrial agriculture should be ended, and people should return to only hunting and gathering-based civilization. In a very real sense, then, all these books invert the basic criticism of veganism, that we are too utopian. They instead argue, to my admittedly somewhat biased mind, infinitely more utopian schemes to imagine a currently non-existent world where it might theoretically be possible to eat animals in either an ethical or sustainable manner. However, such arguments seem to my mind to entirely miss the question at hand. The question is not, is there any possible world in which it might ever be ethically or environmentally sustainable to eat meat, but instead, how should one ethically and sustainably eat in the world in which we actually live? As Peter Singer phrased the argument, the question is never should I eat meat, but should I eat this meat? And the answer to that question, the one we must individually and personally confront each time we sit down to eat, can only be no. That is true 99% of the time, since such meat comes from factory farms, which everyone, Pollen, Kingsolver, Freed, Frehley, and Keith, all agree are personal, ethical, and ecological nightmares. But it is also, I believe, true for that remaining 1% of the time. For what I believe is occurring in all of these books is that they are not causing customers to boycott all factory farm meat, much less all industrial produced foods or all monoculture crops, but instead to believe that an occasional and purely token consumption of so-called humane meat represents effective activism for both animals and the planet. Hence the effect, if not the intent, of all of these books seems to be to simply provide cover for those who continue to consume large amounts of factory farm meat and to live and eat in essence exactly as they did before, but now armed with the belief that eating meat is good for the planet. But what is, at its most fundamental level, wrong with the entire humane slaughter movement is not only that it is, in reality, only serves to help exonerate factory farms, but that the movement is itself, in certain key ways, actually worse than factory farms. For example, according to the United Nations report, Lion Stocks, Lion Shadow, and I talk about this in the chapter in the book, free-range farming is actually worse for the environment in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, land use, and biodiversity than intensification, the report's code word for factory farms. The reason for this counterintuitive suggestion is twofold. In the first place, while methane released from free-range cattle may be slightly less than feedlots, since grass produces slightly less gas than corn, since free-range is less efficient in terms of pounds of meat produced, it actually requires, per a pound, more greenhouse gas emissions to raise animals on free-range pasture than it does in factory farms. More significantly, it also causes the loss of habitat and deforestation, which is in turn the leading cause of erosion of biodiversity and the leading contributing factor of the current mass species extinction of which we are experiencing. This is already true under the current system of animal agriculture. 80% of Brazil's rainforest has been cut down to make room for free-range cattle. But it would be, as incredible as this sounds, at least in terms of species loss, an even worse ecological nightmare if the entire current factory farm system was converted to free-range pasture-fed animals at the current level of meat consumption. And perhaps most importantly, it represents a system that seems even less individually ethical. A person who purchases factory farm meat can at least claim that they did not know what was occurring, that animals feel pain, that they have feelings, that they care whether they live or die. As such, they are, I believe, still within the realm of possible advocacy. but the local and humane slaughterer can offer no such defense. In fact, they themselves daily and routinely take part in the killing of animals and in turn attempt to include as many other people as a stated ethical imperative within these acts of violence, including even young children. As Joel Salatin explains, interestingly, we typically have families come. They want to come and see the chicken butchering, for example. Well, mom and dad, they stay out behind the car, but the 8, 9, 10, and 11-year-old children come around to see this. We've not found any children under 10 that's the least put off by it. They get right into it. We give them a knife, and we let them slit some throats. Therefore, to my mind, such people are not and cannot represent fellow travelers or coalition partners in any authentic move to end violence towards animals. Not only because their goals are utopian and impossible for both practical and environmental reasons, nor because their actions and rhetoric are explicitly anti-vegetarian and anti-vegan, nor even because the real-world effects of their books, talks, and rhetoric, despite repeated claims to the contrary, serves only to exonerate the existing practice of factory farm, but because the actions of all supposed local, humane, and compassionate carnivores are themselves wholly objectionable for all the same basic reasons and values which motivated the critique of factory farm or animal abuse in the first place, that basic and fundamental idea that animals represent more than a mere agricultural commodity for purchase whose life, interest, and simple bodily integrity can be disregarded at will and for profit. Even if factory farm represents 99% of the meat consumed in the United States, we must, I believe, not abandon the 99% of our values a spurious coalition with any type of humane slaughter would require. Thank you.